Welcome, everyone. We have a fantastic speaker tonight, Anton Matley, with Peak Funding. I can also have the pleasure of calling Anton a good friend, Prashant Kumar, my partner here. Why don't you go ahead and say a few things, and I will remain quiet.
Thank you. Thank you, Eddie. Appreciate it. Guys, thank you so much for joining. As Ed says, you know, Ed and I are partners in multifamily realty gains. We are syndicators. You know, not to show off, but last year was a good year. Ed and I were able to partner in about 1,200 units as in GP capacity, bought some assets for ourselves, you know, and participated in various syndications. This year has been a little bit slow as usual, you know why. And we started this series just to network with folks and interview fine leaders in the industry on various topics. Today, we have Anton Matley from Peak Multifamily. And Anton has been the founder and CEO of Peak Multifamily Funding, right, Anton? And basically, Anton comes here with decades of experience in commercial and investment banking, private equity, and commercial real estate. You know, he graduated from Zurich Business School, and after that, he has had many senior positions in major financial institutes in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich, and, you know, we have been working with Anton for the last couple of years. And I mean, in my mind, he has been the finest broker that I have worked with. He takes care of all the deals from the beginning till the end, till you close. And even after closing, you know, I mean, when I was new, Anton was even helping me out how to talk to lenders and stuff. So I said, why not Anton, you know, on our sort of podcast for interview. Anton is here. Anton, thank you so much for joining. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Please feel free to start whenever you are ready.
Okay, very good. Hi, everyone.
I had a basic question which I kind of wanted to level set. I know we talk about Freddie, Fannie, HUD, and CMBS. I just wanted to see, you know, what is the real difference between these four, and what are the scenarios when people should go for HUD loan or Freddie or Fannie or local banks for that matter? I mean, just wanted to start with that if you want to take a couple of minutes, or maybe you want to explain it later on. That's up to you.
Sure, now we certainly can do that. It's always a little bit hard, right, with these get-togethers, because there are a broad range of individuals. Some have a lot of knowledge, others are relatively new to the multifamily space. So we specialize in multifamily financing, and the reason why multifamily is so attractive is that compared to any other commercial real estate, that you have access to agency loans that are only available in the commercial space to multifamily properties. And that includes Fannie, Freddie, as well as FHA, HUD. You do not have any programs for offices, for retail, for industrial, any other commercial real estate to these programs. So that's why multifamily is so attractive when it comes to the financing side. When you start out, the majority of the loans you probably will go into on the agency side is either a small balance or a small loan, as it's called, Fannie. but most likely it will be a Freddie SPL because Freddie SPL is the easiest to get approved, even if you do not have any prior multifamily experience. It still requires that you have a third-party property management company that manages your property, as when you have no prior experience. You will have net worth requirements, liquidity requirements. I do not know whether that has been discussed in some previous events that you, Prashant, and Ed organized. But that's Freddie SPL is certainly the easiest program to get started when it comes to an agency loan.
The big advantage. Sorry, Anton. Yes, it would be easier if you, I mean, feel free to discuss whatever you like to, so that we are not holding any information for our
Okay, people. Sure, yes. So if you have more questions about the differences between Fannie, Freddie, bank, bridge loans, and so on, I'm happy. I provide you with the contact details so you can reach out to me whenever you want, right? So, obviously, the key question is, what is the situation now with the multifamily financing in the current environment? And it is an extremely tough environment for any type of lending. It doesn't really matter whether it's multifamily, whether it's retail, whether it's office, whether it's hotels, whether it's residential, business loans and so on, other than the government loans like the PPP program and the IEDL, it's a very tough environment. But I would like to touch specifically on the two programs that I have touched on before, which is Fannie and Freddie, particularly for those of you who already have been a little bit active in that field, where it's kind of important to understand what the new rules are that they have implemented. Just a little bit about us, between me and my team, we have 50 years plus of multifamily lending experience. We have done billions of transactions, thousands of closed transactions, and we have access to virtually hundreds of lenders from Fannie, Freddie, HUD, bridge lenders, life insurance companies, banks, debt funds, and so on. The reality is, even though we have access to hundreds of lenders, we tend to work with a couple of dozens that are the most trusted lenders where we know that we can get deals closed. Let's talk a little bit about what is happening on the underwriting side, and particularly when it comes to the reserve requirements that some of you probably have heard when it comes to Fannie and Freddie loans. In the past, reserve requirements were sometimes completely waived. And if you had reserve requirements for a Fannie loan, which we talk about first, typically were limited to maybe taxes, maybe insurance, and replacement reserves. And that was also limited to maybe a couple of months, 3 months, 6 months, depending on the transaction. What has never really been implemented in the past were reserves for principal and interest payments. And with COVID-19 hitting us, both Fannie and Freddie implemented very tight new reserve requirements when it comes to both real estate taxes, insurance, and replacement reserves, certainly on the Fannie side, and severe reserves also for principal and interest. And the principal interest applies even when it's a loan that is for interest only. On the Freddie side, I've touched on that later, they are now willing to apply it just for the interest only period if it's an interest only loan. But as a general rule, for Fannie. The Fannie has multiple tiers, as they call them. The tier 2, tier 3, and tier 4 are the most commonly used. For most syndicators, they fall into the tier 2 and tier 3 buckets, with the tier 2 going up to 80% LTV and typically a minimum 1.25 debt service coverage. Tier 3 are up to 65 LTV and 1.35, and then tier 4 is up to 55 and 155 debt service coverage. Very few syndicators fall into the tier 4 bucket because it requires a significant amount of equity that needs to be raised, and it, in most instances, is too low of a leverage to generate the returns that syndicators would need. But we see it with individual investors that want to have, or families that want to have, lower leverage. Some institutional investors also use the tier 4 buckets to get advantage of very aggressive terms. So now when we look at these reserve requirements that Fannie now has implemented, we talk about the 6 million, for loans under 6 million, we talk about 18 months of principal and interest. And for loans that are above the 6 million mark, it's still 12 months of principal and interest. On top of that, you also have 12 months of real estate taxes, insurance, and replacement reserves. Replacement reserves, for those of you who are maybe new to that, to multifamily, in the commercial sense, typically replacement reserves are $250 per unit. That need to be that need to put into reserve. So it can go higher, but that $250 per unit is typically the minimum level. So as you move down the tier into a lower leverage and the higher debt service coverage, luckily that reserve requirement drops to 6 months, and once you are in the tier 4, then you're essentially or down to an exemption, which is not really a surprise, right? Once you're at that 55 leverage and 155 minimum debt service coverage, the lenders and Fannie have enough comfort that they do not feel that you need to have any reserve in place. Now, a couple of things to note. If you have to draw from the principal and interest, you do not have to replenish it. So that's positive in a way, but obviously you do not really want to draw from the principal and interest because that means that you are kind of in under distress. One positive factor in a way is that the maximum amount of principal and interest reserve is 10%. That's not really helping much, but at least it's capped, right? So when it comes to the release of the reserves, that's also a pretty tough pill to swallow, because it's essentially, and again, we talk here specifically about Fannie, it's 6 months plus two consecutive quarters of a minimum at the minimum tier at 1.25 in the tier or 1.35 in the tier 3 as a debt service coverage that you need to achieve. And that can go all the way to 3 years if you do not achieve that, right? So it's these reserves can sit in there for quite a while. Also, if you have any commercial space, that's particularly for mixed-use properties in more urban environments or newer developments, where you have retail at the bottom or office space at the bottom, the commercial income is completely excluded unless it's an essential business. So just another thing to consider. On the Freddie side, it's a little bit different and actually more beneficial compared to Fannie. With they have different rules. They do not have these tier 2, 3, and 4 as what we see with Fannie. So you have to look at it. They look at it a little bit different. So they drive it primarily by a debt service coverage ratio. And for when we look at the Freddie conventional, which is essentially above the Freddie SBL program, which is 6 million, above 6 million, or above 7.5 million for properties that are have less than 100 units. So if you have a debt service coverage below 1.4, then you have a 9 month of principal and interest. You do not have to escrow for insurance taxes and replacement reserves, right? As a general rule, Freddie may still require it, but at least it's not a written rule. And that is a massive advantage compared to a Fannie loan of an equal size and equal rate. So just to give you a little bit of a picture there, because it's only the principal and interest and because it's only for 9 months rather than 12 months, we talk here about a fraction of what you actually have to put into reserve compared to a Fannie loan. With Freddie SBL, it's 12 months, so it's slightly higher. And so that you just have to be aware of that, that with the Freddie SBL, it's a little bit higher. Now, when it comes to releasing the reserves with the Freddie program, that is actually also much better compared to Fannie. When you recall on the Fannie side, essentially you are stuck for at least 12 months with the reserve sitting with the lender for a very large amount. Whereas with Freddie, they have different rules. One of the rules is that you need to have a physical occupancy for 3 consecutive months, which typically, as some of you may not know, is that for agency loans, in order to get into an agency loan to start out, you have the so-called 9490 rule. So the physical occupancy essentially should be 90% plus for 90 days. So having to meet that 80% physical occupancy after you close the loan is actually a pretty low hurdle. That's very positive. However, you also need to have the 3 months average collections that essentially have to be at that level that it supports the debt service coverage that was required at the loan closing. So you still need to meet that debt service coverage essentially that you originally agreed with. If there is any outstanding due diligence that hasn't been done, then that would also have to be completed. Just to give you an idea, right now, a lot of the due diligence that is being done for agency loans are virtual to a large extent. We have, just on Monday, we had a virtual due diligence tour for a Freddie loan, and that was essentially done with a Zoom call. So we had obviously, people from the property were on site. We had the property condition assessor, the engineer, he was on site, but the appraiser was not on site, the lender was not on site, the Freddie at that point was not on site. So everything essentially was underwritten, is going to be underwritten based on that Zoom call, and they will plan to go out to the property after the federal, state, and local shelter in place and or emergency declarations are lifted. So that deferred due diligence, whatever has been deferred, still needs to be completed. So now, what is also important, isn't it, what is really very beneficial is that in some states where they will be lifting all the shelter-in-place requirements, as well as any emergency declarations, once that has been lifted for 90 days, you essentially can apply to get these reserves back, right? So in a best case scenario, let's take Texas as an example. I'm based in Texas and some other states that have been affected as much as New York and some other markets. It's more likely that these states will reopen completely and there is no shelter in place requirement issued. So as a result, let's say that it happens in a state by July 1st, as an example, within 3 months after that, you will be able to apply for to get these reserves back. So that is significantly better than what Fannie currently has, where you are still sitting on these reserves for at least 12 months. And on top of it, as I mentioned earlier, with Fannie, you have a significant higher amount to start with. So that is a big advantage with Freddie. It's definitely a big advantage when you look at Freddie SBL compared to a Fannie small loan. When it comes to Freddie conventional compared to Fannie conventional, you have to be a little bit careful to understand that, yes, it's much more attractive. However, as a general rule, Freddie is not as aggressive when it comes to Class C and B minus properties. So Freddie tends to be more picky when it comes to properties. And that means that when it comes to a larger property that would have to go into a Freddie conventional loan, more often than not, it may not work with Freddie, particularly in the current environment, whereas with Fannie it may work, right? So we try whenever possible to put our clients into a Freddie program if it works, because of that reason, and everything else is equal or very similar. But it's just something that you have to be aware of, that it's not that easy for the larger loans, the so-called conventional loans, to actually get it approved by Freddie. When it comes to Freddie SBL, it's a very different story. Freddie SBL is very much driven by affordable properties in the C-class space. A massive amount of Freddie SBL loans are C-class properties, so there is no issue there whatsoever. So it's a very big difference between the Freddie SBL program and the Freddie conventional when it comes to some of these.
I have two questions here. Yeah. One is somebody is asking is what is the right time to engage a lender when somebody's properties, and should somebody engage a lender?
We advise to do that in pre-COVID, right? Whenever you have a deal, what we recommend is, obviously you have two choices. You can approach a lender directly, or you can approach a more commercial mortgage broker like us. We would recommend to use a mortgage broker because we can guide you to the right lenders. Just as a side note, even among the agency lenders for between Fannie and Freddie, there are maybe 3 dozen agency lenders out there. Not every lender will be a perfect fit for you as a sponsor as well as for you as a property. And that requirement might change depending on the location of the deal too. So obviously we recommend to go with a broker, but even if you do go directly to a lender, it's extremely important that you talk to a broker or lender before you even submit an LOI. I know there are some buyers that are sending out a lot of LOIs without even considering whether they can get the financing in place. That's one strategy. The danger with that strategy is that if you then get an LOI approved and you're not able to get the financing based on what you assumed originally, you essentially dead in the water and your reputation is down the drain with the seller. And if you submitted it to a broker, that broker will not be willing to show you any future deals. And the multifamily space is very small, so your reputation will travel pretty fast. So just to be aware of that. So the preferred approach from my perspective is as soon as you have a deal that you underwrote, you feel that it's a good deal from your perspective, reach out to someone like us, have it validated that your debt underwriting that you assume is being validated. And very often we give you input where we believe your underwriting might be a little bit off from a lending perspective. Doesn't mean that you cannot achieve what you say that you're achieving, but we are essentially guiding you to let you know how a lender will underwrite the deal. And based on that, you have a pretty high confidence level what kind of financing you're able to get before you even submit that LOI. Once you have an accepted LOI, then it's even more important at that point to revisit the financing, look at new financials, updated financials, and re-underwrite the deal again during the time while you are negotiating the PSA, so that if there are any issues with the financing at that point, that we can bring it up before you actually sign that PSA and put earnest money down. Luckily today, very few sellers now ask for hard money due to COVID, but that was particularly important pre-COVID when it was very common that you had to put down 1-3% of hard earnest money on day one. So then it was even more important. So that's what we generally recommend.
So a follow-up question to that, Anton, is somebody is asking that would a broker like you provide an accompanying letter along with LOI? Is that something that is getting common nowadays? Or, I mean, I haven't really heard anybody asking for a broker letter along with LOI, but have you seen that kind of thing?
It happens more often with smaller deals. Typically, it's coming from brokers that are primarily active in the single family space, but happen to have a commercial property that they are also selling, and also smaller owners of smaller multifamily properties, maybe in that up to 20, maybe 30 unit space. Once you get above that, most sellers and brokers understand that that is not a common thing to do. What you still have to realize is that you typically have, particularly for larger properties with commercial brokers, they ask you to complete a questionnaire, and that questionnaire will ask you in pretty much detail how you look at the transaction. They sometimes even ask for your pro forma, and they also ask how does your financing look like? Have you secured the financing? Who is the broker and or lender you already have approached, and so on? And some of our clients, they include our contact details so that the broker and or seller can reach out to us just to validate and verify that they actually have talked to us about the financing, and that's typically is sufficient.
So, very good. That's a very good explanation, answer to the question. I had a question. So I wanted to ask that, is it up to the borrower to choose what kind of loan, tier two or three, tier three versus tier four, or is it Freddie based on criteria, based on underwriting Freddie offers, whether it is tier two or tier three or tier four, that's what they would choose to offer to the borrower?
Yes. So it depends, right? So if a loan qualifies for a tier two, let's say, if it's a very good purchase price or a refinancing at a relatively low loan amount compared to the valuation and the cash flow, you as a borrower can choose whether you want to go for a tier two, three or four loan, right? However, what happens in most instances, particularly with syndicators, they are targeting a tier two loan, ideally close to 80% leverage with a 1.25 debt service coverage, where Fannie and the lenders may decide that based on the location of the property and based on the sponsors and any other issues that they may think are potentially problematic, that they say we are not willing to go with a tier two, we are only willing to go with a tier three, and or that they say we go with a tier two but we only go with 70% leverage and maybe a 1.30 debt service coverage, right? So now there are certain markets that are so-called pre-review where Fannie says, in this particular market, you as a lender, you're not allowed to do the so-called delegated underwriting, right? So with Fannie, they have the so-called DUS program, which is essentially a delegated underwriting allowance, where as long as you meet all the rules of tier two or tier three or tier four for a particular market, a lender doesn't have to go back to Fannie at all to present that loan. So in other words, that as long as you meet all the requirements and you do not need a so-called waiver from Fannie, a lender can look at the loan, underwrite the loan, and close the loan without Fannie ever seeing that loan. They will see it eventually once the loan is sold to Fannie and then sent over to Fannie with all the packaging information, and then they will review it. But it's too late at that point for Fannie to go back and say, oh, sorry, guys, we don't like it. Fannie may slap some lenders on their wrist if they were too aggressive with the underwriting, but once it's submitted, it's done. So because of that, Fannie decides for certain markets where they are not feeling comfortable to go with a so-called tier two, then they will say, for this market, we allow to go only for a tier three on a delegated basis. If you want to go above that 65 and 135, you need to come back to Fannie for a waiver, right? And then there are some markets where Fannie will say, even if it's a tier three and below, we still want to see that deal, right? So as an example, obviously, right now we have oil and gas situation. When you look at some of these markets, they will insist that every single deal in these markets will be presented to Fannie, regardless of the leverage, unless it may drop down to the tier four level, and then they are fine again with delegated underwriting. So it depends on the markets. These markets change on a regular basis. I know that now for June 1st, Fannie has already announced some new changes to these pre-review markets. We know that, for example, Las Vegas will be a preview, which is not really a surprise. All of Louisiana will be in our preview. All of Oklahoma will be a preview. Michigan will also be preview. And some markets within Michigan, as well as within Oklahoma, will be in tighter, where they do not allow anyone to come in with a deal that is a tier three without Fannie's actually looking at it. And Ohio is going to be the same thing. So this is always changing, essentially on a month, but that's only quarterly basis, where Fannie looks at their portfolio, looks at which loans perform well, where do they have either an overextension of loans in a market, or where they see some trouble spots, where a lot of loans in the portfolio are not performing that well. So that's where they are going to make these changes to the program.
Anton, could you dig a little deeper into the pre-review? Because I know I have at least one person on here that's from Michigan, and they're looking in Michigan, and you know, that might be a...
Okay, sure, yes. So what's going to come out on June the 1st is that all of Michigan is pre-review, which means that preview level one, which, so preview actually has two levels. One is level one and one is level two. Level one is that as long as a lender does a loan at tier three and better, meaning 65% and 135 debt service coverage, then the lender can do that loan completely on a delegated basis. So that's with the level one. However, Flint and Detroit, they will place into a so-called level two, which means that even if you do a loan that is at tier three or better, that Fannie still will require that the lender will submit that loan for a pre-review. So depending on where you are within that market, a lender may be able to do it as a fully delegated at 65/135, or then actually have to go back to Fannie if it's in Flint and Detroit. Now, that doesn't mean that even though we have that tier three requirement at 65/135, that one potentially cannot go up to a higher leverage, right? So we have done deals pre-COVID. We haven't seen anything yet that we were able to push that high. But pre-COVID, we had these pre-review markets where, like, as an example, Houston has been a pre-review level one for a very long time. And so that means essentially 65/1.35 debt service coverage. And we were able to push the leverage to 75/125 in the best case. In other instances, we may have been able to get it to 70% and 1.30 as a debt service coverage. So there is the ability to get above that. It's just that Fannie will have to approve it. And naturally, they take the market into consideration, the property in consideration, as well as the sponsor experience and sponsor financial strength. And based on that, then they will decide how far they are willing to push it.
Thanks, Anton.
Thank you, Anton. So, Anton, sorry we kind of broke the chain of your presentation.
Oh, no worries.
Yeah, please continue. You know,
So let's talk a little bit about forbearance, right? Because that has been on the in the news and has been discussed by some to great length. Both Fannie and Freddie have offered that forbearance for multifamily properties. The repayment period for both after initial 90-day forbearance period is 12 months. They do not charge you any fees or additional interest for it, right? So that's a true forbearance. But you still have a so-called hardship requirement. You cannot just ask for forbearance. You actually need to show that your property has deteriorated to a point where you need that forbearance. So it's important to understand that if you already were in trouble with your property pre-COVID-19, it's much harder to convince Fannie or Freddie that you actually now are in trouble because of COVID, right? So they may not grant that forbearance, but it's only in markets, obviously the most extreme, like New York City, where you essentially have a major hotspot, then you have massive issues with collections, also due to the very publicly announced non-eviction rules and so on. So you have significantly higher defaults there. So there it makes obviously sense for Fannie and Freddie to approve it. But in some other markets where, when we look in various places across the country where collections are still coming in at 90% plus of where March collections were, it's very hard to argue that you really need that forbearance, right? But let's assume that one is able to get a forbearance. One needs to be very careful to consider one more aspect. And there, Fannie again is more aggressive when it comes to in their favor than Freddie is. Evictions during the forbearance period are not allowed, which obviously makes sense in a way. And frankly speaking, with all the no eviction rules that have been already put in place in a lot of jurisdictions, it's not such a big problem to start with, right? Now, the big difference, at least up to right now, is with Freddie. Once you start repaying that forbearance, since you are no longer in the forbearance period, you're allowed to evict again. With Fannie, that you are not allowed to evict until you have your forbearance completely repaid, right? So that means that in a worst case with Fannie, as it is right now, it may change, but as it is right now, if you go into a forbearance and you need 12 months to repay because your cash flow doesn't allow it to repay faster, you potentially are now sitting with a property where you cannot evict for more than a year, up to 15 months. So that needs to be, that's why a forbearance really needs to be considered very carefully, particularly when it comes to a Fannie loan. Now, both Fannie and Freddie said when you ask for a forbearance because of COVID, it will not impact your borrowing ability from Fannie and Freddie down the road. That is another aspect that we just do not know whether they will stick to their word or not, right? We have seen that they followed that rule with other periods when there were forbearances, like doing hurricane or tornado damages, when they designated certain areas as disaster areas and borrowers were allowed to ask for forbearance. In those instances, they did not penalize these borrowers when they asked for forbearance. But we do not know whether that is still the case here. So, frankly speaking, my view is if you can avoid it, do not go for forbearance. You may consider to actually do a capital call instead, even though it hurts, right? And tell the investors to return the equity once everything has calmed down. And the other option, obviously, is, as many of you have done, is just stop distributions until the storm is over, so that you have a little bit more of a cushion if it gets tighter. So in summary, I would say be very careful with that forbearance. It's really something that you do not really want to get into lightly. I have a couple of other slides, but maybe that's a little bit too much detail. Just touch it very at the very high level. If you have a loan that potentially has the forbearance requirement, I would say reach out to the servicer of that loan as quickly as you can before you actually need it, so that you know who they are and that you can reach out to them and they already know you. Also go through your loan documentation really with a fine comb. It's important that you understand what it means, what is in these loan agreements, particularly clauses that may cause a recourse, right? So both Fannie and Freddie are non-recourse loans. However, there are a lot of items that potentially can trigger a recourse. Obviously, the most obvious is fraud. And assuming that there is no fraud, then you may think, well, then I do not have an issue. Well, that's not really the case. You can commit gross negligence, and that can include insurance or many other items. So it's important that you keep the eye on the ball, that you know what potentially can trigger a personal recourse. And obviously that you also have everything up to date, right? So that your financials are up to date, your personal financials are up to date, so that if you want, need to ask for a forbearance, that you're all ready to go, right? So, by the way, when it comes to forbearance, we a lot of banks were willing to grant some form of forbearance or loan modifications. So that's outside, obviously, of Fannie and Freddie. They are much more flexible there, or at least have been more flexible. That window probably has been closing quite a bit, because the more trouble these banks have with the loan portfolio, the less willing they are to enter into loan modifications and or do not have time to deal with them. But if you have a bank loan, I would say, and you feel that you may need it, it's worthwhile to talk to your bank. I know a number of borrowers that have had success even without actually having a need for a forbearance or loan modification, but the lenders were willing to accommodate them. So just as a tip, if you have a bank loan, that might be worthwhile to consider. So when you have a loan under application right now, or you have a transaction that you are considering to buy, right, I think you have to be obviously very careful and have no doubt that you are, if you're considering to buy a property right now, that you are taking a lot of elements into consideration. But you really have to consider that the collections, as they have been presented to you now, even up to May, that they may not be at that level by the time you close. We have right now, I believe, the strong collection performance that we have seen across the multifamily portfolio across the country has been driven to a significant extent by the stimulus checks, as well as the bonus, $600 per week bonus unemployment check that the federal government is paying on top of the state benefits that are being paid out. You probably have heard about it, that you have a lot of unemployed individuals that now are more being unemployed than they ever earned before they were unemployed. And that only helps them to pay the rent, right? As these checks drop off, and right now it's at the end of July, obviously the House proposal wants that to continue. We do not know what's going to happen in the Senate, what they come up with, but at some point that is going to run out, even if it's extended for a certain period of time. So with an unemployment at the level where we are right now, we all know that it would be impossible to keep collections up where they are today. So it has to be driven by these stimulus checks and unemployment benefits, bonus benefits, because particularly in the C-class space, most people have less than $400 that they have available for emergencies. So once that unemployment bonus falls away and there is no job for them to go back to, you have to expect higher default. So when you underwrite, assume that you will have lower collections, which has a direct impact on your cash flow that is used to underwrite that loan, which means that your loan proceeds will be lower. Obviously, reserve requirements we already talked about, they may change, but right now make sure that you know what the reserve requirements are, not just for a Fannie and Freddie, but even with a bank, right? We have seen situations where someone was talking to banks because they didn't want to go into a Fannie loan and felt, well, they were all giddy about it until the bank came back and said, well, by the way, we need, I think it was 9 months of P&I reserve. And then eventually that was brought down to 6 months. But you really need to understand what, with every offer that you have in hand, that you really understand what the reserve requirements are. And because of all that, really, I think it's important that you raise enough equity regardless. My view is, even if the reserve requirements come down, I would still consider to raise equity for that principal and interest for at least 6 months, probably for 12 months, because again, my fear is that these collections will drop once these stimulus checks and bonus and unemployment checks run out. And the last thing you want is that you run into a problem with your loan right out of the gate.
So how much is the volume? How much is the volume, Anton? Volume drop you have seen in last couple of months? I mean, how many transactions? Is it completely at standstill right now, or I mean, transactions are happening?
Yes, our volume is of actual deals that we have currently running is 1/5 of where we were before, right? So it's roughly at 20%, right? Okay. Now, interest rates are extremely attractive, right? We have, for a large Fannie and Freddie loan in a good market that also has affordability benefits, you can get a 10-year or a 12-year loan at below 3%, right? So it's an extremely attractive loan. However, you have to reserve requirements. But on top of it, if you are a buyer of a property, a lot of buyers are just holding back because they do not really know, right? So there are some, we have some clients that are active buyers, and that's the ones where we are still working with. But mm-hmm. a significant portion of buyers are now holding back and want to see how the chips fall. When it comes to refinancings, a lot of the refinancings also have put on a hold because of the reserve requirements. And everyone kind of hopes that within maybe 2 months or 3 months, Fannie and Freddie will lower these reserve requirements. So rather than doing the refinancing now, they decided to push it out, right? We have some that decided to still do it, because they felt, look, the rates are attractive. We are fine with all the reserves sitting in there for an year, because we are happy to have that cushion anyhow. But a significant amount of borrowers just have put a pause on that too and are in a waiting mode.
So it's like the new deals which are stalling, or is it the deals which were already in progress while when the COVID started in March, after March 22nd?
Yeah. I mean, we had a number of deals that fell through that were already under application because the borrower, the buyer essentially walked away from the deal. That covered bridge loans as well as agency loans. And now we are mostly working on deals, apart from a number of refinancings, of acquisition deals that have been already in the pipeline before and where we try to find a way to get still into the best possible situation. Some of them we have pushed out by a month or two because the lender wanted to see at least the May collections. And now with the May collections having come in, or a significant portion of it, now they are willing to push it forward. Right. So there are still deals that we can do and that we are doing. It's just that the volume is more, certainly on the acquisition side, it's mostly still whatever was in the pipeline.
Okay. Very good. So yeah.
And then, Anton, have a question here. Okay. It's actually a question from Sean in Michigan there. And so let's say you do you go into a PSA and you have 30 days due diligence. First off, at what point do you start the loan application process? And secondly, at what point is it determined what tier you're going to be in? And thirdly, at what point is the interest rate locked in? I mean, I've seen that happen like a week before even, but...
Yes. Yeah. So it's obviously here we talk specifically about Fannie, right? Freddie is a different story. On the Freddie SBL side, if it's small enough of a deal, again, the loan amount up to $6 million or $7.5 million if it's 100 units or less, which potentially would be the best option. With Freddie SBL, you have the advantage that the interest rate is so-called locked when you apply for the loan. It's technically not locked. It's still subject to the deal being submitted to Freddie within a certain time period. But essentially, it turns into a rate lock right when you apply for the loan. So that's a massive advantage that you have with a Freddie SBL. Freddie conventional is the same as Fannie conventional as well as the Fannie small loan. So there, the rate lock is typically a week or two before you close. In the past, they offered early rate locks, then they stopped doing that, and now they are starting to slowly implement it again. But that comes at the cost. So generally, I would say 99% of the clients are locking maybe a week or two before you actually close the loan. So what were the other questions, Ed?
The tiers, what tier you're in, that is determined probably pretty far up front, right?
Yes. Well, yes, and that's also the, when should you apply for the loan, right? So right now, what I would recommend, obviously it takes longer to get things done as a general rule. Frankly speaking, right now, it's not really the lenders and Fannie and Freddie any longer that hold up a loan to the largest extent. It's more because of the local situation, right? So if you have still shelter in place, stay at home orders in place, emergency in place, where the governments are not open and so on, that is probably a higher risk where it just takes longer to close. So what we recommend right now is that you assume that you will have at least 90 days from the PSA signing until you close. Can you go more aggressive? Absolutely, right? We have a deal that we will close within less than 60 days. But it really depends on a location by location basis. To be on the safe side, I would say use plenty of time for your own personal due diligence period. Don't go for any hard money right now. Have a financing contingency built in that you always can get out. And so I would say have at least 75 days to 90 days in total, plus another 2 times 15 days of an extension option. Typically, I don't think you get even close to that. The reality is we just do not know. There just needs to be an additional spike. And in a worst case, it's right in the location of the property and everything comes to a halt. So you need to include a massive amount of time there just to be safe. I would also include a specific COVID-19 clause in the LOI as well as in the PSA. Obviously, your lawyer has to advise you how that wording specifically is, but essentially that as long as you have a stay in place or a shelter in place or an emergency, that your time clock essentially does not start until that is lifted. So that's a recommendation that we use, and I think a lot of real estate lawyers also suggest to use, so that you have that flexibility, that you have the full benefit of a true due diligence period once you're able to have full access to the property and inspectors have access and so on. Now, when it comes to applying for the loan, and the tier level, what I would suggest is, as you have a deal that you're looking at, show it to us with the T12 rent roll, if it's a formal offering, the offering memorandum, your PSA, your REO schedule, essentially your whole package, your bio, and based on that, we can look at it, we can underwrite it, and we can informally at least talk to a couple of lenders and or Fannie to see where we potentially would end up with this, right? So based on that, at least we can give you an early indication whether it is safe to go with certain assumptions and whether it's safe to submit an LOI based on your lending assumptions. Before you submit the PSA or before you sign the PSA, I would say we then can go in and ask for more specifics. Again, with Fannie, we can go in and ask for waivers at that point. And or we do that once you sign the PSA and you just need to have enough of a financing contingency in there so that we can essentially start that discussion with Fannie. Once you have signed the PSA, you do your due diligence while we do the pre-review with Fannie. And usually within a week to 2 weeks, we have the answer from Fannie. So you will know at that point at what level Fannie would be comfortable to come in at.
Thank you very much. That's helpful.
Very good. Very good, Anton. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time today. I mean, we try to keep it within an hour unless anybody has any question.
No, I think looks like we're pretty good there.
Very good. All right. From myself and from my partner at Moselle, I mean, We thank you very much for your time, and I hope our listeners have enjoyed. But once again, thank you so much all for your time.